room and let the morning's announcements wash over him. The terror ran endlessly on in his mind, making him feel like a rat trapped on an exercise wheel. And when he tried to look ahead to some better, brighter time, he could see only darkness. The ship was his sanity, and it was sinking. Mr. Harley, the headmaster, approached the podium and imparted a brief exordium about the importance of finals week, and how the grades they received would constitute another step upon the great road of life. He told them that the school was depending on them, he was depending on them, and their parents were depending on them. He did not tell them that the entire free world was depending on them, but he strongly implied that this might be so. He finished by telling them that bells would be suspended during finals week, the first and only piece of good news Jake had received that morning. Miss Franks, who had assumed her seat at the piano, struck an invocatory chord. The student body, 70 boys and 50 girls, each turned out in a neat and sober way that bespoke their parents' taste and financial stability, rose as one and began to sing the school song. Jake mouthed the words and thought about the place where he had awakened after dying. At first he had believed himself to be in hell, and when the man in the black hooded robe came along, he had been sure of it. Then, of course, the other man had come along, a man Jake had almost come to love. "But he let me fall. He killed me." He could feel prickly sweat breaking out on the back of his neck and between his shoulder blades. "So we hail the halls of Piper, hold its banner high. Hail to thee, our alma mater, Piper, do or die." God, what a shitty song, Jake thought. And it suddenly occurred to him that his father would love it. 2. Period 1 was English comp, the only class where there was no final. Their assignment had been to write a final essay at home. This was to be a typed document between 1,500 and 4,000 words long. The subject Ms. Avery had assigned was My Understanding of Truth. The final essay would count as 25% of their final grade for the semester. Jake came in and took his seat in the third row. There were only 11 pupils in all. Jake remembered orientation day last September when Mr. Harley had told them that Piper had the highest teacher-to-student ratio of any fine private middle school in the East. He had popped his fist repeatedly on the lectern at the front of the common room to emphasize this point. Jake hadn't been terribly impressed, but he had passed the information along to his father. He thought his father would be impressed, and he had not been wrong. He unzipped his book bag and carefully removed the blue folder which contained his final essay. He laid it on his desk, meaning to give it a final look over, when his eye was caught by the door at the left side of the room. It led, he knew, to the cloakroom, and it was closed today because it was 70 degrees in New York and no one had a coat which needed storage. Nothing back there except a lot of brass coat hooks and a line on the wall and a long rubber mat on the floor for boots. A few boxes of school supplies, chalk, blue books, and such were stored in the far corner. No big deal. All the same, Jake rose from his seat, leaving the folder unopened on the desk, and walked across to the door. He could hear his classmates murmuring quietly together, and the riffle of pages as they checked their own final essays for that crucial misplaced modifier or fuzzy phrase. But these sounds seemed far away. It was the door which held his attention. In the last 10 days or so, as the voices in his head grew louder and louder, Jake had become more and more fascinated with doors, all kinds of doors. He must have opened the one between his bedroom and the upstairs hallway 500 times in just the last week, and the one between his bedroom and the bathroom 1,000. Each time he did it, he felt a tight ball of hope and anticipation in his chest, as if the answer to all of his problems lay somewhere behind this door or that one, and he would surely find it eventually. But each time it was only the hall or the bathroom or the front walk or whatever. Last Thursday he had come home from school, thrown himself on his bed, and had fallen asleep. Sleep, it seemed, was the only refuge which remained to him. Except when he'd awakened, 45 minutes later, he had been standing in the bathroom doorway, peering dazedly in at nothing more exciting than the toilet and the basin. Luckily, no one had seen him. Now, as he approached the cloakroom door, he felt that same dazzling burst of hope, a certainty that the door would not open on a shadowy closet containing only the persistent smells of winter, flannel, rubber, and wet wool, but on some other world where he could be whole again. Hot, dazzling light would fall across the classroom floor in a widening triangle, and he would see birds circling in a faded blue sky the color of his eyes, old jeans. A desert wind would blow his hair back and dry the nervous sweat on his brow. He would step through this door and be healed. Jake turned the knob and opened the door. Inside was only darkness and a row of gleaming brass hooks. One long-forgotten mitten lay near the stacked piles of blue books in the corner. His heart sank, and suddenly Jake felt like simply creeping into that dark room with its bitter smells of winter and chalk dust. He could move the mitten and sit in the corner under the coat hooks. He could sit on the rubber mat where you were supposed to put your boots in the wintertime. He could sit there, put his thumb in his mouth, pull his knees tight against his chest, close his eyes, and just give up. This idea, the relief of this idea, was incredibly attractive. It would be an end to the terror and confusion and dislocation. That last was somehow the worst, that persistent feeling that his whole life had turned into a funhouse mirror maze. Yet, there was deep steel in Jake Chambers, as surely as there was deep steel in Eddie and Susanna. Now it flashed out its dour blue lighthouse gleam in the darkness. There would be no giving up. Whatever was loose inside him might tear his sanity away from him in the end, but he would give it no quarter in the meantime. Be damned if he would. Never, he thought fiercely. Never! Never! When you finished your inventory of the school supplies in the cloakroom, John, perhaps you'd care to join us, Miss Avery said from behind him in her dry, cultured voice. There was a small gust of giggles as Jake turned away from the cloakroom. Miss Avery was standing behind her desk with her long fingers tented lightly on the blotter, looking at him out of her calm, intelligent face. She was wearing her blue suit today, and her hair was pulled back in its usual bun. Nathaniel Hawthorne looked over her shoulder, frowning at Jake from his place on the wall. "Sorry," Jake muttered and closed the door. He was immediately seized by a strong impulse to open it again, to double-check, to see if this time that other world with its hot sun and desert vistas was there. Instead, he walked back to his seat. Petra Jesserling looked at him with merry, dancing eyes. "Take me in there with you next time," she whispered. "Then you'll have something to look at." Jake smiled in a distracted way and slipped into his seat. "Thank you, John," Miss Avery said in her endlessly calm voice. "Now, before you pass in your final essays, which I am sure will all be very fine, very neat, very specific, I should like to pass out the English Department's short list of recommended summer reading. I will have a word to say about several of these excellent books." As she spoke, she gave a small stack of mimeographed sheets to David Surrey. David began to hand them out, and Jake opened his folder to take a final look at what he had written on the topic, My Understanding of Truth. He was genuinely interested in this, because he could no more remember writing his final essay than he could remember studying for his French final. He looked at the title page with puzzlement and growing unease. My Understanding of Truth by John Chambers was neatly typed and centered on the sheet, and that was all right. But he had, for some reason, pasted two photographs below it. One was of a door. He thought it might be the one at number 10 Downing Street in London, and the other was of an Amtrak train. They were color shots, undoubtedly culled from some magazine. Why did I do that? And when did I do it? He turned the page and stared down at the first page of his final essay, unable to believe or understand what he was seeing. Then, as understanding began to trickle through his shock, he felt an escalating sense of horror. It had finally happened. He had finally lost enough of his mind so that other people would be able to tell. Three. My Understanding of Truth by John Chambers. I Will Show You Fear in a Handful of Dust. T.S. Butch Eliot. My first thought was, he lied in every word. Robert Sundance Browning. The gunslinger is the truth. Roland is the truth. The prisoner is the truth. The Lady of Shadows is the truth. The prisoner and the lady are married. That is the truth. The way station is the truth. The speaking demon is the truth. We went under the mountains, and that is the truth. There were monsters under the mountain. That is the truth. One of them had an Amoco gas pump between his legs and was pretending it was his penis. That is the truth. Roland let me die. That is the truth. I still love him. That is the truth. And it is so very important that you all read The Lord of the Flies, Miss Avery was saying in her clear but somehow pale voice. And when you do, you must ask yourselves certain questions. A good novel is often like a series of riddles within riddles, and this is a very good novel, one of the best written in the second half of the 20th century. So ask yourselves first, what the symbolic significance of the conch shell might be. Second, far away. Far, far away. Jake turned to the second page of his final essay with a trembling hand, leaving a dark smear of sweat on the first page. When is a door not a door? When it's ajar, and that is the truth. Blaine is the truth. Blaine is the truth. What has four wheels and flies? A garbage truck, and that is the truth. Blaine is the truth. You have to watch Blaine all the time. Blaine is a pain, and that is the truth. I'm pretty sure that Blaine is dangerous, and that is the truth. What is black and white and red all over? A blushing zebra, and that is the truth. Blaine is the truth. I want to go back, and that is the truth. I have to go back, and that is the truth. I'll go crazy if I don't go back, and that is the truth. I can't go home again unless I find a stone, a rose, a door, and that is the truth. Choo-choo, and that is the truth. Choo-choo, 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 I am afraid. That is the truth. Choo-choo. Jake looked up slowly. His heart was beating so hard that he saw a bright light like the afterimage of a flashbulb dancing in front of his eyes, a light that pulsed in and out with each titanic thud of his heart. He saw Miss Avery handing his final essay to his mother and father. Mr. Bassett was standing beside Miss Avery, looking grave. He heard Miss Avery say in her clear, pale voice, "Your son is seriously ill. If you need proof, just look at this final essay." "John hasn't been himself for the last 3 weeks or so," Mr. Bassett added. "He seems frightened some of the time, and dazed all of the time. Not quite there, if you see what I mean. Je pense que Jean est fou. Comprenez-vous?" "Miss Avery again, do you perhaps keep certain mood-altering prescription drugs in the house where John might have access to them?" Jake didn't know about mood-altering drugs, but he knew his father kept several grams of cocaine in the bottom drawer of his study desk. His father would undoubtedly think he had been into it. "Now let me say a word about Catch-22," Miss Avery said from the front of the room. "This is a very challenging book for sixth and seventh grade students, but you will nonetheless find it entirely enchanting if you open your minds to its special charm. You may think of this novel, if you like, as a comedy of the surreal. I don't need to read something like that, Jake thought. I'm living something like that, and it's no comedy. He turned over to the last page of his final essay. There were no words on it. Instead, he had pasted another picture to the paper. It was a photograph of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. He had used a crayon to scribble it black. The dark, waxy lines looped and swooped in lunatic coils. He could remember doing none of this. Absolutely none of it. Now he heard his father saying to Mr. Bissette, "Foo! Yes, he's definitely foo. A kid who'd fuck up his chance at a school like Piper has to be foo, wouldn't you say? Well, I can handle this. Handling things is my job. Sunnyvale's the answer. He needs to spend some time in Sunnyvale, making baskets and getting his shit back together. Don't you worry about our kid, folks. He can run, but he can't hide." Would they actually send him away to the nut hatch if it started to seem that his elevator no longer went all the way to the top floor? Jake thought the answer to that was a big you bet. No way his father was going to put up with a loony around the house. The name of the place they put him in might not be Sunnyvale, but there would be bars on the windows, and there would be young men in white coats and crepe-soled shoes prowling the halls. The young men would have big muscles and watchful eyes and access to hypodermic needles full of artificial sleep. "They'll tell everybody I went away," Jake thought. The arguing voices in his head were temporarily stilled by a rising tide of panic. "They'll say I'm spending the year with my aunt and uncle in Modesto, or in Sweden as an exchange student, or repairing satellites in outer space. My mother won't like it. She'll cry, but she'll go along. She has her boyfriends. And besides, she always goes along with what he decides. He felt a shriek welling up in his throat and pressed his lips tightly together to hold it in. He looked down again at the wild black scribble snarled across the photograph of the Leaning Tower and thought, "I have to get out of here. I have to get out right now." He raised his hand. "Yes, John, what is it?" Miss Avery was looking at him with the expression of mild exasperation she reserved for students who interrupted her in mid-lecture. "I'd like to step out for a moment, if I may," Jake said. This was another example of Piper speak. Piper students did not ever have to take a leak or tap a kidney or, God forbid, drop a load. The unspoken assumption was that Piper students were too perfect to create waste byproducts in their tastefully silent glides through life. Once in a while, someone requested permission to step out for a moment, and that was all. Miss Avery sighed. "Must you, John?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"All right. Return as soon as possible."
"Yes, Miss Avery."
He closed the folder as he got up, took hold of it, then reluctantly let go again. No good. Miss Avery would wonder why he was taking his final essay to the toilet with him. He should have removed the damning pages from the folder and stuffed them in his pocket before asking for permission to step out. Too late now. Jake walked down the aisle toward the door, leaving his folder on the desk and his book bag lying beneath it.
"Hope everything comes out all right, Chambers," David Surrey whispered and snickered into his hand.
"Still your restless lips, David," Miss Avery said, clearly exasperated now, and the whole class laughed. Jake reached the door leading to the hall, and as he grasped the knob, that feeling of hope and surety rose in him again.
"This is it. Really it. I'll open the door and the desert sun will shine in. I'll feel that dry wind on my face. I'll step through and never see this classroom again."
He opened the door, and it was only the hallway on the other side. But he was right about one thing, just the same. He never saw Miss Avery's classroom again. Four. He walked slowly down the dim, wood-paneled corridor, sweating lightly. He walked past classroom doors he would have felt compelled to open, if not for the clear glass windows set in each one. He looked into Mr. Bessette's French 2 class and Mr. Knopf's introduction to geometry class. In both rooms, the pupils sat with pencils in hand and heads bowed over open blue books. He looked into Mr. Harley's spoken arts class and saw Stan Dorfman, one of those acquaintances who are not quite friends, beginning his final speech. Stan looked scared to death, but Jake could have told Stan he didn't have the slightest idea what fear, real fear, was all about. I died. No, I didn't. Did too. Did not. Did. Didn't. He came to a door marked Girls. He pushed it open, expecting to see a bright desert sky and a blue haze of mountains on the horizon. Instead, he saw Belinda Stevens standing at one of the sinks, looking into the mirror above the basin and squeezing a pimple on her forehead.
"Jesus Christ, do you mind?" she asked.
"Sorry, wrong door. I thought it was the desert."
"What?"
But he had already let the door go, and it was swinging shut on its pneumatic elbow. He passed the drinking fountain and opened the door marked Boys. This was it. He knew it, was sure of it. This was the door which would take him back. 3 urinals gleamed spotlessly under the fluorescent lights. A tap dripped solemnly into a sink. That was all. Jake let the door close. He walked on down the hall, his heels making firm little clicks on the tiles. He glanced into the office before passing it and saw only Ms. Franks. She was talking on the telephone, swinging back and forth in her swivel chair and playing with a lock of her hair. The silver-plated bell stood on the desk beside her. Jake waited until she swiveled away from the door and then hurried past. 30 seconds later, he was emerging into the bright sunshine of a morning in late May.
"I've gone truant," he thought.
Even his distraction did not keep him from being amazed at this unexpected development. "When I don't come back from the bathroom in 5 minutes or so, Miss Avery will send somebody to check. And then they'll know. They'll all know that I've left school, gone truant." He thought of the folder lying on his desk.
"They'll read it and they'll think I'm crazy. Foo. Sure they will. Of course. Because I am."
Then another voice spoke. It was, he thought, the voice of the man with the bombardier's eyes, the man who wore the 2 big guns slung low on his hips. The voice was cold, but not without comfort. "No, Jake," Roland said, "you're not crazy. You're lost and scared, but you're not crazy, and need fear neither your shadow in the morning striding behind you, nor your shadow at evening rising to meet you. You have to find your way back home, that's all."
"But where do I go?"
Jake whispered. He stood on the sidewalk of 56th Street between Park and Madison, watching the traffic bolt past. A city bus snored by, laying a thin trail of acrid blue diesel smoke.
"Where do I go? Where's the fucking door?"
But the voice of the gunslinger had fallen silent. Jake turned left, in the direction of the East River, and began to walk blindly forward. He had no idea where he was going, no idea at all. He could only hope his feet would carry him to the right place, as they had carried him to the wrong one not long ago. Five. It had happened 3 weeks earlier. One could not say it all began 3 weeks earlier, because that gave the impression that there had been some sort of progression. And that wasn't right. There had been a progression to the voices, to the violence with which each insisted on its own particular version of reality. But the rest of it had happened all at once. He left home at 8 o'clock to walk to school. He always walked when the weather was good, and the weather this May had been absolutely fine. His father had left for the network, his mother was still in bed, and Mrs. Greta Shaw was in the kitchen drinking coffee and reading her New York Post. "Goodbye, Greta," he said. "I'm going to school now." She raised a hand to him without looking up from the paper.
"Have a good day, Johnny."
All according to routine. Just another day in the life. And so it had been for the next 1,500 seconds. Then everything had changed forever. He idled along, book bag in one hand, lunch sack in the other, looking in the windows. 720 seconds from the end of his life, as he had always known it, he paused to look in the window of Brendio's, where mannequins dressed in fur coats and Edwardian suits stood in stiff poses of conversation. He was thinking only of going bowling that afternoon after school. His average was 158, great for a kid who was only 11. His ambition was to someday be a bowler on the pro tour, and if his father had known this little factoid, he also would have hit the roof. Closing in now, closing in on the moment when his sanity would be suddenly eclipsed. He crossed 39th, and there were 400 seconds left. Had to wait for the walk light at 41st, and there were 270. Paused to look in the novelty shop on the corner of 5th and 42nd, and there were 190. And now, with just over 3 minutes left in his ordinary life, Jake Chambers walked beneath the unseen umbrella of that force which Roland called Ka-Tet. An odd, uneasy feeling began to creep over him. At first he thought it was a feeling of being watched, and then he realized it wasn't that at all, or not precisely that. He felt that he had been here before, that he was reliving a dream he had mostly forgotten. He waited for the feeling to pass, but it didn't. It grew stronger, and now began to mix with a sensation he reluctantly recognized as terror. Up ahead, on the near corner of 5th and 43rd, a black man in a Panama hat was setting up a pretzel and soda cart. "He's the one that yells, 'Oh my God, he's killed,' Jake thought. Approaching the far corner was a fat lady with a Bloomingdale's bag in her hand. "She'll drop the bag and put her hands to her mouth and scream. The bag will split open. There's a doll inside the bag. It's wrapped in a red towel. I'll see this from the street, from where I'll be lying in the street with my blood soaking into my pants and spreading around me in a pool." Behind the fat woman was a tall man in a gray nailhead worsted suit. He was carrying a briefcase. "He's the one who vomits on his shoes. He's the one who drops his briefcase and throws up on his shoes. What's happening to me?" Yet his feet carried him numbly forward toward the intersection, where people were crossing in a brisk, steady stream. Somewhere behind him, closing in, was a killer priest. He knew this, just as he knew that the priest's hands would in a moment be outstretched to push. But he could not look around. It was like being locked in a nightmare where things simply had to take their course. 53 seconds left now. Ahead of him, the pretzel vendor was opening a hatch in the side of his cart. "He's going to take out a bottle of Yoo-Hoo," Jake thought. "Not a can, but a bottle. He'll shake it up and drink it all at once." The pretzel vendor brought out a bottle of Yoo-Hoo, shook it vigorously, and spun off the cap. 40 seconds left. Now the light will change. White walk went out. Red don't walk began to flash rapidly on and off. And somewhere, less than half a block away, a big blue Cadillac was now rolling toward the intersection of 5th and 43rd. Jake knew this, just as he knew the driver was a fat man wearing a hat almost the exact same blue shade as his car. "I'm going to die!" He wanted to scream this aloud to the people walking heedlessly all around him, but his jaws were locked shut. His feet swept in serenely onward toward the intersection. The don't walk sign stopped flashing and shone out its solid red warning. The pretzel vendor tossed his empty Yoo-Hoo bottle into the wire trash basket on the corner. The fat lady stood on the corner across the street from Jake, holding her shopping bag by the handles. The man in the nailhead suit was directly behind her. Now there were 18 seconds left. "Time for the toy truck to go by," Jake thought. Ahead of him, a van with a picture of a happy jumping jack and the words "Tooker's Wholesale Toys" printed on the side swept through the intersection, jolting up and down in the potholes. Behind him, Jake knew, the man in the black robe was beginning to move faster, closing the gap, now reaching out with his long hands. Yet he could not look around, as you couldn't look around in dreams when something awful was gaining on you.
"Run! And if you can't run, sit down and grab hold of a no parking sign. Don't just let it happen."
But he was powerless to stop it from happening. Ahead, on the edge of the curb, was a young woman in a white sweater and a black skirt. To her left was a young Chicano guy with a boombox. A Donna Summer disco tune was just ending. The next song, Jake knew, would be Dr. Love by Kiss. They're going to move apart. Even as the thought came, the woman moved a step to her right. The Chicano guy moved a step to his left, creating a gap between them. Jake's traitor feet swept him into the gap. 9 seconds now. Down the street, bright May sunshine twinkled on a Cadillac hood ornament. It was, Jake knew, a 1976 sedan DeVille. 6 seconds. The caddy was speeding up. The light was getting ready to change, and the man driving the DeVille, the fat man in the blue hat with the feathers stuck jauntily in the brim, meant to scat through the intersection before it could. 3 seconds. Behind Jake, the man in black was lunging forward. On the young man's boombox, Love to Love You Baby ended, and Dr. Love began. 2. The Cadillac changed to the lane nearest Jake's side of the street and charged down on the intersection, its killer grill snarling. 1. Jake's breath stopped in his throat. None. Ah! Jake cried as a hand struck him firmly in the back, pushing him into the street, pushing him out of his life. Except there were no hands. He reeled forward, nevertheless, hands flailing at the air, his mouth a dark O of dismay. The Chicano guy with the boombox reached out, grabbed Jake's arm, and hauled him backward.
"Look out, little hero," he said. "That traffic turned you into bratwurst."
The Cadillac floated by. Jake caught a glimpse of the fat man in the blue hat peering out through the windshield, and then it was gone. That was when it happened. That was when he split down the middle and became two boys. One lay dying in the street. The other stood here on the corner, watching in dumb, stricken amazement as Don't Walk turned to walk again, and people began to cross around him just as if nothing had happened. As indeed, nothing had.
"I'm alive!"
half of his mind rejoiced, screaming with relief.
"Dead!"
the other half screamed back.
"Dead in the street! They're all gathering around me, and the man in black who pushed me is saying, 'I am a priest, let me through.'"
Waves of faintness rushed through him and turned his thoughts to billowing parachute silk. He saw the fat lady approaching, and as she passed, Jake looked into her bag. He saw the bright blue eyes of a doll peeping above the edge of a red towel, just as he had known he would. Then she was gone. The pretzel vendor was not yelling, "Oh my God, he's killed!" He was continuing to set up for the day's business while he whistled the Donna Summer tune that had been playing on the Chicano guy's radio. Jake turned around, looking wildly for the priest who was not a priest. He wasn't there. Jake moaned.
"Snap out of it! What's wrong with you?"
He didn't know. He only knew that he was supposed to be lying in the street right now, getting ready to die, while the fat woman screamed and the guy in the nailhead worsted suit threw up and the man in black pushed through the gathering crowd. And in part of his mind, that did seem to be happening. The faintness began to return. Jake suddenly dropped his lunch sack to the pavement and slapped himself across the face as hard as he could. A woman on her way to work gave him a queer look. Jake ignored her. He left his lunch lying on the sidewalk and plunged into the intersection, also ignoring the red Don't Walk light, which had begun to stutter on and off again. It didn't matter now. Death had approached and then passed by without a second glance. It hadn't been meant to happen that way, and on the deepest level of his existence he knew that. But it had. Maybe now he would live forever. The thought made him feel like screaming all over again. Six. His head had cleared a little by the time he got to school, and his mind had gone to work trying to convince him that nothing was wrong. Really nothing at all. Maybe something a little weird had happened, some sort of psychic flash, a momentary peek into one possible future, but so what? No big deal, right? The idea was actually sort of cool. The kind of thing they were always printing in the weird supermarket newspapers Greta Shaw liked to read when she was sure Jake's mother wasn't around. Papers like the National Enquirer and Inside View. Except, of course, in those papers, the psychic flash was always a kind of tactical nuclear strike. A woman who dreamed of a plane crash and changed her reservations, or a guy who dreamed his brother was being held prisoner in a Chinese fortune cookie factory, and it turned out to be true. When your psychic flash consisted of knowing that a Kiss song was going to play next on the radio, that a fat lady had a doll wrapped in a red towel in her Bloomingdale's bag, and that a pretzel vendor was going to drink a bottle of Yoo-hoo instead of a can, how big a deal could it be? Forget it, he advised himself. It's over. A great idea, except by period 3, he knew it wasn't over. It was just beginning. He sat in pre-algebra, watching Mr. Knopf solving simple equations on the board, and realized with dawning horror that a whole new set of memories was surfacing in his mind. It was like watching strange objects float slowly toward the surface of a muddy lake. I'm in a place I don't know, he thought. I mean, I will know it, or would have known it, if the Cadillac had hit me. It's the way station. But the part of me that's there doesn't know that yet. That part only knows it's in the desert someplace and there are no people. I've been crying because I'm scared. I'm scared that this might be hell. By 3 o'clock, when he arrived at Midtown Lanes, he knew he had found the pump in the stables and had gotten a drink of water. The water was very cold and tasted strongly of minerals. Soon he would go inside and find a small supply of dried beef in a room which had once been a kitchen. He knew this as clearly and surely as he'd known the pretzel vendor would select a bottle of Yoo-hoo and that the doll peeking out of the Bloomingdale's bag had blue eyes. It was like being able to remember forward in time. He bowled only 2 strings, the first in 96, the second in 87. Timmy looked at his sheet when he turned it in at the counter and shook his head. You're having an off day today, champ, he said. You don't know the half of it, Jake said. Timmy took a closer look. You okay? You look really pale. I think I might be coming down with a bug. This didn't feel like a lie, either. He was sure as hell coming down with something. Go home and go to bed, Timmy advised. Drink lots of clear liquids. Gin, vodka, stuff like that. Jake smiled dutifully. Maybe I will. He walked slowly home. All of New York was spread out around him. New York at its most seductive. A late afternoon street serenade with a musician on every corner, all the trees in bloom, and everyone apparently in a good mood. Jake saw all this, but he also saw behind it, saw himself cowering in the shadows of the kitchen as the man in black drank like a grinning dog from the stable pump, saw himself sobbing with relief as he, or it, moved on without discovering him, saw himself falling deeply asleep as the sun went down and the stars began to come out like chips of ice in the harsh purple desert sky. He let himself into the duplex apartment with his key and walked into the kitchen to get something to eat. He wasn't hungry, but it was habit. He was headed for the refrigerator when his eye happened on the pantry door, and he stopped. He realized suddenly that the way station and all the rest of that strange other world where he now belonged was behind that door. All he had to do was push through it and rejoin the Jake that already existed there. The queer doubling in his mind would end, the voices endlessly arguing the question of whether or not he had been dead since 8:25 that morning would fall silent. Jake pushed open the pantry door with both hands, his face already breaking into a sunny, relieved smile, and then froze as Mrs. Shaw, who was standing on a step stool at the back of the pantry, screamed. The can of tomato paste she had been holding dropped out of her hand and fell to the floor. She tottered on the stool, and Jake rushed forward to steady her before she could join the tomato paste.
"Moses in the bulrushes," she gasped, fluttering a hand rapidly against the front of her house dress. "You scared the bejabbers out of me, Johnny." "I'm sorry," he said.
He really was, but he was also bitterly disappointed. It had only been the pantry after all. He had been so sure.
"What are you doing creeping around here anyway? This is your bowling day. I didn't expect you for at least another hour. I haven't even made your snack yet, so don't be expecting it.
That's okay, I'm not very hungry anyway.
He bent down and picked up the can she had dropped.
Wouldn't know it from the way you came busting in here, she grumbled.
I thought I heard a mouse or something. I guess it was just you.
I guess it was.
She descended the step stool and took the can from him.
You look like you're coming down with the flu or something, Johnny.
She pressed her hand against his forehead.
You don't feel hot, but that doesn't always mean much.
I think I'm just tired, Jake said, and thought if only that was all it was. Maybe I'll just have a soda and watch TV for a while.
She grunted.
You got any papers you want to show me? If you do, make it fast. I'm behind on supper.
Nothing today, he said.
He left the pantry, got a soda, then went into the living room. He turned on Hollywood Squares and watched vacantly as the voices argued and the new memories of that dusty other world continued to surface. 7. His mother and father didn't notice anything was wrong with him. His father didn't even get in until 9:30, and that was fine by Jake. He went to bed at 10 and lay awake in the darkness, listening to the city outside his window. Brakes, horns, wailing sirens.
You died. I didn't, though. I'm right here, safe in my own bed.
That doesn't matter.
You died, and you know it.
The hell of it was, he knew both things.
I don't know which voice is true, but I know I can't go on like this. So just quit it, both of you. Stop arguing and leave me alone, okay? Please?
But they wouldn't. Couldn't, apparently. And it came to Jake that he ought to get up right now and open the door to the bathroom. The other world would be there. The way station would be there. And the rest of him would be there, too, huddled under an ancient blanket in the stable, trying to sleep and wondering what in hell had happened.
I can tell him, Jake thought excitedly.
He threw back the covers, suddenly knowing that the door beside his bookcase no longer led into the bathroom, but to a world that smelled of heat and purple sage and fear and a handful of dust, a world that now lay under the shadowing wing of night.
I can tell him, but I won't have to, because I'll be in him. I'll be him.
He raced across his darkened room, almost laughing with relief, and shoved open the door, And it was his bathroom. Just his bathroom, with the framed Marvin Gaye poster on the wall and the shapes of the Venetian blinds lying on the tiled floor in bars of light and shadow. He stood there for a long time, trying to swallow his disappointment. It wouldn't go. And it was bitter. Bitter. 8. The 3 weeks between then and now stretched like a grim, blighted terrain in Jake's memory. A nightmare wasteland where there had been no peace, no rest, no respite from pain. He had watched, like a helpless prisoner watching the sack of a city he had once ruled, as his mind buckled under the steadily increasing pressure of the phantom voices and memories. He had hoped the memories would stop when he reached the point in them where the man named Roland had allowed him to drop into the chasm under the mountains, but they didn't. Instead, they simply recycled and began to play themselves over again, like a tape set to repeat and repeat until it either breaks or someone comes along and shuts it off. His perceptions of his more or less real life as a boy in New York City grew increasingly spotty as this terrible schism grew deeper. He could remember going to school and to the movies on the weekend and out to Sunday brunch with his parents a week ago, or had it been 2. But he remembered these things the way a man who has suffered malaria may remember the deepest, darkest phase of his illness. People became shadows, voices seemed to echo and overlap each other, and even such a simple act as eating a sandwich or obtaining a Coke from the machine in the gymnasium became a struggle. Jake had pushed through those days in a fugue of yelling voices and doubled memories. His obsession with doors, all kinds of doors, deepened. His hope that the gunslinger's world might lie behind one of them never quite died, nor was that so strange, since it was the only hope he had. But as of today, the game was over. He'd never had a chance of winning, anyway, not really. He had given up. He had gone truant. Jake walked blindly east along the gridwork of streets, head down, with no idea of where he was going or what he would do when he got there. Nine. After walking for a while, he began to come out of this unhappy daze and take some notice of his surroundings. He was standing on the corner of Lexington Avenue and 54th Street with no memory at all of how he had come to be there. He noticed for the first time that it was an absolutely gorgeous morning. May 9th, the day this madness had started, had been pretty, but today was 10 times better. That day, perhaps, when spring looks around herself and sees summer standing nearby, strong and handsome and with a cocky grin on his tanned face. The sun shone brightly off the glass walls of the midtown buildings. The shadow of each pedestrian was black and crisp. The sky overhead was a clear and blameless blue, dotted here and there with plump, foul-weather clouds. Down the street, two businessmen in expensive, well-cut suits were standing at a board wall which had been erected around a construction site. They were laughing and passing something back and forth. Jake walked in their direction, curious, and as he drew closer, he saw that the two businessmen were playing tic-tac-toe on the wall, using an expensive Mark Cross pen to draw the grids and make the X's and O's. Jake thought this was a complete gas. As he approached, one of them made an O in the upper right-hand corner of the grid and then slashed a diagonal line through the middle. "Skunked again," his friend said. Then this man, who looked like a high-powered executive or lawyer or big-time stockbroker, took the Mark Cross pen and drew another grid. The first businessman, the winner, glanced to his left and saw Jake. He smiled. "Someday, huh, kid?" "It sure is," Jake said, delighted to find he meant every word. "Too nice for school, huh?" This time Jake actually laughed. Piper's school, where you had outs instead of lunch, and where you sometimes stepped out but never had to take a crap, suddenly seemed far away and not at all important. "You know it. You want a game? Billy here couldn't beat me at this when we were in the fifth grade, and he still can't."
"Leave the kid alone," the second businessman said, holding out the Mark Cross pen. "This time you're history." He winked at Jake, and Jake amazed himself by winking back. He walked on, leaving the men to their game. The sense that something totally wonderful was going to happen, had perhaps already begun to happen, continued to grow, and his feet no longer seemed to be quite touching the pavement. The walk light on the corner came on, and he began to cross Lexington Avenue. He stopped in the middle of the street so suddenly that a messenger boy on a 10-speed bike almost ran him down. It was a beautiful spring day, agreed, but that wasn't why he felt so good, so suddenly aware of everything that was going on around him, so sure that some great thing was about to occur. The voices had stopped. They weren't gone for good, he somehow knew this, but for the time being they had stopped. Why? Jake suddenly thought of two men arguing in a room. They sit facing each other over a table, jawing at each other with increasing bitterness. After a while, they begin to lean toward each other, thrusting their faces pugnaciously forward, bathing each other with a fine mist of outraged spittle. Soon they will come to blows. But before that can happen, they hear a steady thumping noise, the sound of a bass drum, and then a jaunty flourish of brass. The two men stop arguing and look at each other, puzzled. "What's that?" one asks. "Dunno," the other replies. "Sounds like a parade." They rush to the window, and it is a parade. A uniformed band marching in lockstep with the sun blazing off their horns, pretty majorettes twirling batons and strutting their long tanned legs, convertibles decked with flowers and filled with waving celebrities. The two men stare out the window, their quarrel forgotten. They will undoubtedly return to it, but for the time being they stand together like the best of friends, shoulder to shoulder, watching as the parade goes by. 10. A horn blared, startling Jake out of this story, which was as vivid as a powerful dream. He realized he was still standing in the middle of Lexington, and the light had changed.
He looked around wildly, expecting to see the blue Cadillac bearing down on him. But the guy who had tooted his horn was sitting behind the wheel of a yellow Mustang convertible and grinning at him. It was as if everyone in New York had gotten a whiff of happy gas today. Jake waved at the guy and sprinted to the other side of the street. The guy in the Mustang twirled a finger around his ear to indicate that Jake was crazy, then waved back and drove on. For a moment, Jake simply stood on the far corner, face turned up to the May sunshine, smiling, digging the day. He supposed prisoners condemned to die in the electric chair must feel this way when they learn they've been granted a temporary reprieve. The voices were still. The question was, what was the parade which had temporarily diverted their attention? Was it just the uncommon beauty of this spring morning? Jake didn't think that was all. He didn't think so because that sensation of knowing was creeping over him and through him again, the one which had taken possession of him 3 weeks ago as he approached the corner of 5th and 46th. But on May 9th it had been a feeling of impending doom. Today it was a feeling of radiance, a sense of goodness and anticipation. It was as if... white. This was the word that came to him, and it clanged in his mind with clear and unquestionable rightness. "It's the white," he exclaimed aloud, "the coming of the white." He walked on down 54th Street, and as he reached the corner of 2nd and 54th, he once more passed under the umbrella of Ka Tet. 11. He turned right, then stopped, turned, and retraced his steps to the corner. He needed to walk down 2nd Avenue now, yes, that was unquestionably correct, but this was the wrong side again. When the light changed, he hurried across the street and turned right again. That feeling, that sense of whiteness, rightness, grew steadily stronger. He felt half mad with joy and relief. He was going to be okay. This time there was no mistake. He felt sure that he would soon begin to see people he recognized, as he had recognized the fat lady and the pretzel vendor, and they would be doing things he remembered in advance. Instead, he came to the bookstore. 12. The Manhattan Restaurant of the Mind, the sign painted in the window read. Jake went to the door. There was a chalkboard hung there. It looked like the kind you saw on the wall in diners and lunchrooms. Today's specials. From Florida, fresh broiled John D. McDonald. Hardcovers, 3 for $2.50. Paperbacks, 9 for $5. From Mississippi, pan-fried William Faulkner. Hardcovers, market price. Vintage library paperbacks, 75 cents each. From California, hard-boiled Raymond Chandler. Hardcovers, market price. Paperbacks, 7 for $5. Feed your need to read. Jake went in, aware that he had, for the first time in 3 weeks, opened a door without hoping madly to find another world on the other side. A bell jingled overhead. The mild, spicy smell of old books hit him, and the smell was somehow like coming home. The restaurant motif continued inside. Although the walls were lined with shelves of books, a fountain-style counter bisected the room. On Jake's side of the counter were a number of small tables with wire-backed malt shop chairs. Each table had been arranged to display the day's specials. Travis McGee novels by John D. McDonald, Philip Marlowe novels by Raymond Chandler, Snopes novels by William Faulkner. A small sign on the Faulkner table said, "Some rare first eds available. Please ask." Another sign, this one on the counter, read simply, "Browse." A couple of customers were doing just that. They sat at the counter, drinking coffee and reading. Jake thought this was without a doubt the best bookstore he'd ever been in. The question was, why was he here? Was it luck, or was it part of that soft, insistent feeling that he was following a trail, a kind of force beam that had been left for him to find? He glanced at the display on a small table to his left, and knew the answer. 13. It was a display of children's books. There wasn't much room on the table, so there were only about a dozen of them. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, The Hobbit, Tom Sawyer, things like that. Jake had been attracted by a storybook obviously meant for very young children. On the bright green cover was an anthropomorphic locomotive puffing its way up a hill. Its cowcatcher, which was bright pink, wore a happy grin, and its headlight was a cheerful eye, which seemed to invite Jake Chambers to come inside and read all about it. Charlie the Choo-Choo, the title proclaimed, story and pictures by Beryl Evans. Jake's mind flashed back to his final essay, with the picture of the Amtrak train on the title page and the words Choo-Choo written over and over again inside. He grabbed the book and clutched it tightly as if it might fly away if he relaxed his grip. And as he looked down at the cover, Jake found that he did not trust the smile on Charlie the Choo-Choo's face. "You look happy, but I think that's just the mask you wear," he thought. "I don't think you're happy at all, and I don't think Charlie's your real name either." These were crazy thoughts to be having, undoubtedly crazy. But they did not feel crazy. They felt sane. They felt true. Standing next to the place where Charlie the Choo-Choo had been was a tattered paperback. The cover was quite badly torn and had been mended with scotch tape now yellow with age. The picture showed a puzzled-looking boy and girl with a forest of question marks over their heads. The title of this book was Riddle-de-Dum, Brain Twisters and Puzzles for Everyone. No author was credited. Jake tucked Charlie the Choo-Choo under his arm and picked up the riddle book. He opened it at random and saw this. "When is a door not a door?" "When it's ajar," Jake muttered. He could feel sweat popping out on his forehead, his arms, all over his body. "When it's ajar..." "Find something, son?" a mild voice inquired. Jake turned around and saw a fat guy in an open-throated white shirt standing at the end of the counter. His hands were stuffed in the pockets of his old gabardine slacks. A pair of half-glasses were pushed up on the bright dome of his bald head. "Yes," Jake said feverishly. "These two, are they for sale?"
"Everything you see is for sale," the fat guy said. "The building itself would be for sale if I owned it. Alas, I only lease."
He held out his hand for the books, and for a moment Jake balked. Then, reluctantly, he handed them over. Part of him expected the fat guy to flee with them. And if he did, if he gave the slightest indication of trying it, Jake meant to tackle him, rip the books out of his hands, and boogie. He needed those books.
"Okay, let's see what you got," the fat man said. "By the way, I'm Tower, Calvin Tower." He stuck out his hand.
Jake's eyes widened, and he took an involuntary step backward.
"What?"
The fat guy looked at him with some interest.
"Calvin Tower, which word is profanity in your language, O Hyperborean wanderer?"
"Huh?"
"I just mean you look like someone goosed you, kid."
"Oh, sorry."
He clasped Mr. Tower's large, soft hand, hoping the man wouldn't pursue it. The name had given him a jump, but he didn't know why.
"I'm Jake Chambers."
Calvin Tower shook his hand. "Good handle, pard. Sounds like the footloose hero in a Western novel. The guy who blows into Black Fork, Arizona, cleans up the town, and then travels on. Something by Wayne D. Overholser, maybe. Except you don't look footloose, Jake. You look like you decided the day was a little too nice to spend in school."
"Oh, no, we finished up last Friday."
Tower grinned.
"Uh-huh, I bet. And you've got to have these two items, huh? It's sort of funny what people have to have. Now you. I would have pegged you as a Robert Howard kind of kid from the jump, looking for a good deal in one of those nice old Donald M. Grant editions, the ones with the Roy Krenkel paintings. Dripping swords, mighty thews, and Conan the Barbarian hacking his way through the Stygian hordes."
"That sounds pretty good, actually. These are for my little brother. It's his birthday next week."
Calvin Tower used his thumb to flip his glasses down onto his nose and had a closer look at Jake.
"Really? You look like an only child to me."
An only child, if I ever saw one, enjoying a day of French leave, as Mistress May trembles in her green gown just outside the bosky dell of June.
Come again?
Never mind. Spring always puts me in a William Cowperish mood. People are weird but interesting, Tex. Am I right?
I guess so,
Jake said cautiously. He couldn't decide if he liked